on access to the Oregon Health Plan. And the first item on the agenda is the adoption of committee rules. The committee rules that we have in front of us are the standard rules adopted by all other legislative committees, as far as I know. Senator Trill?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Trill moves the adoption of the rules for the Senate Special Committee on Access to the Oregon Health Plan. Any discussion? Any objection to the adoption of the rules? There's none. They are adopted. I'd like to welcome members to this committee, and Representative Cruz was invited by the chair along with Representative Winters. She's not here, but the general concept and idea of this committee is to try to increase the level of knowledge and understanding that the various members of the Senate have regarding what the Oregon Health Plan is today. Some of us were here back in 1991 and before, in 1993, when we first funded the Oregon Health Plan, and the concepts that existed at that time with respect to the various prioritized lists of services that were going to be used as originally envisioned. There's a lot of rumor, a lot of misinformation, a lot of information floating around about what the Oregon Health Plan either is or is not. One of the things that we do know is that the Oregon Health Plan is an expanding program and an ever more costly program to the state budget. So the objective of this committee is going to be to begin to dissect the Oregon Health Plan as it is in its current form, what the constituent audiences are that the Oregon Health Plan intends to serve, what kind of services they provide, and hopefully we can get into some comparative analysis of what other states are doing and where the other states are going. The objective, in addition to that, is to try to help refine and make the program work more efficiently. We have a Secretary of State's audit that was issued a number of months ago. There were some issues in that audit that were brought to my attention, one specifically relevant to the number of participants within the program who are not authorized under federal law or other laws to be in the program at all. And in subsequent conversations I've had with individuals regarding those persons, it's been told to me, reported to me, that it's very difficult to find out who those individuals are and to get individuals who are in that program off who are not qualified. So it's a huge task. This committee, if the Senate President consents, will continue to exist throughout the rest of this year and leading into the upcoming special, or excuse me, regular session of the legislature. And hopefully we'll have the cooperation of the various state agencies and other participants that have an interest in the Oregon Health Plan and its success or failure, whichever that might be in terms of your interest. But hopefully we have people who are participating in terms of constructive criticisms and constructive proposals for how this program should function in the future. Senator Clarno, I know, has been doing some work on this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along with Representative Cruz, Representative Winters, Representative Doyle, Senator Fisher, and others, and staff, Rick, and others who've tried to see what we can do to not only contain costs, but to provide services that those who are without health insurance can continue those services, but also seeing ways in which we could acknowledge some changes that need to be made and enact those changes. Especially in conjunction with the Secretary of State's audit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and I don't know, Senator Trill and I worked as co-chairs of Ways and Means back in 93. We'd probably like to forget much of that era. But one of the ways that I like to function or operate as the chair of a committee is to try to reduce things down to this most common denominator so that everybody has kind of an evolutionary understanding of what's in front of us. I think, Senator Trill, you recall that during 1993 we had, again, another significant budget problem, about a $1.2 billion problem. Only this time it was when the economy was growing as opposed to declining, but we were shifting monies from property taxes to the state general fund. The education, higher education particularly, was under attack. And one of the things that we did then was have the agency come in and actually teach us a class on what the Oregon higher education system is and what it's intended to do and who the participants are. And I think ultimately we were well served in the long term by doing that. So, any other comments by members? Senator Perry-Owen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to conform my understanding to your opening comments and just clarify for my own purposes. This committee will operate as a standing committee from now until the regular session in 2003, if the President agrees.
That is true. That is consistent with my conversation with the Senate President earlier today.
And so I'm just wanting to make sure that people understand this is not necessarily connected to the current special legislative session or the current budgetary considerations that we're under, that this committee is a committee that is here to decide whether or not the Oregon Health Plan should be continued under its current configuration or whether it should be reconfigured. And it will ultimately, this committee will ultimately have to answer the question of whether or not the Oregon Health Plan in its current configuration is sustainable or not sustainable, and to make recommendations to the 2003 regular legislature under the regular legislative session. So it's a big job. It potentially has sweeping implications for the Oregon Health Plan and the people that are involved with the health plan, either as service providers or as clients and customers. And, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to emphasize that this is not connected with the legislative special sessions that were in process, that this is a bigger issue with a much broader focus, and that it will exist beyond the current special session.
And the caveat is with the consent of the Senate President, who
yes.
controls the first thing. But no, I think that your comments regarding the sustainability of the Oregon Health Plan is something to keep in mind. One of the questions many of us have is whether or not we can continue to afford to do what we're doing with expanding programs in the Oregon Health Plan, education, corrections, et cetera, whether or not we can continue to afford to pay for what we're creating here. So we first have to understand what it is we've created and where it's going to figure out whether or not we can afford to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So that's good. I mean, there may be some bit of information that comes to our attention that may compel us to have legislation drafted, but that is not the primary objective of this committee.
I was just going to say that why it was created in the first place and why it's needed right now is another factor that ought to be considered, because I think it's become part of the fabric of services that we provide in the state, and it's equally as needed in rural Oregon as it is in urban Oregon, and a lot of people's lives depend upon successfully functioning. So in a situation where we have a lot of poverty in the state, a lot of unemployment, a lot of underemployment in terms of wages that are paid and so forth, having adequate health care is really very important. So I think that ought to be factored in as well.
Right. So I agree 100%. In fact, I think that we make better decisions when we have a level of knowledge and understanding about what we are doing. And that's, again, one of the objectives is to try to get beyond just the general innuendo. I know that Senator Representative Cruz has fairly specialized knowledge in this area because you deal with it and have dealt with it in the past. So you've got some things. And one of the reasons that I wanted you here was to kind of chime in from time to time and say, we plowed that ground before and here's what we found. So I'm going to task staff to collate or to assemble as many documents and analyses as we can find regarding the Oregon Health Plan and individuals smarter than us who have had an opportunity to look at it to help us understand it better. So we're all going to have homework assignments in the sense that we're going to need to start reading through a lot of the documents that we're going to be getting, and so it's incumbent upon members to try to keep up and do that and make that commitment to this process, because hopefully the product we'll produce at the end of this will be something that we'll be able to bridge into some proactive legislation into the next session. President Cruz, comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will chime in at this point, shy as I am. I did spend a significant amount of time the last 2 years dealing with this, and the first thing I want to say is to a degree we are characterized on the outside being Republicans and being what Republicans are, that we are trying to kill the Oregon Health Plan, and nothing could be further from the truth. to. Our purpose was to try to save the Oregon Health Plan, because the way things are moving currently, we are coming up probably in the next legislative session with expansions in two key areas, healthcare and education, that we are going to be having to choose healthcare or education, and I think that's absolutely wrong that we would be put in that position. We moved most of last session in an alternative direction to what the Oregon Health Plan currently is. And I thought we were moving there fairly successfully. That success kind of ended with Sine Die, and we seem to be back in the same old mold we were before, and that is to try to find a way to sustain the existing program. There is a lot of information out there. There clearly is a lot of information out there, and I guess one of the suggestions I would make, Mr. Chair, you talked briefly about some of the potential fraud or other malfeasance that happens in the system. I happen to know that Representative Doyle has been deeply involved in that part of the process, and I might suggest that he might be another good addition to this panel because of his work in that. We are going to end up, I think, with a quite an extensive series of legislative pieces to deal with all the aspects of this, because it's not just the Oregon Health Plan itself. And if we go into a recreation into something else, that's a modification of it, it's going to have a domino effect on other things that we do, and we know that. So bringing in Representative Doyle, I think, would help us kind of get that perspective. I know you sit on the Joint Judiciary Committee. There are things there that play into this. Representative Winters, for her deep involvement in the DHS reorganization, is a key component to the thing, because it plays into that. You know, how in the reorganization, how do the parts of DHS that function for the Oregon Health Plan work, and what kind of streamlining can we do from the state perspective in administration of Medicare and Medicaid? It certainly plays into this. I am in the process, Mr. Chair, of writing a newspaper article I was requested to do. It's being edited at the moment, and I would be more than happy to distribute that to members of the committee when it's in, when all the words are spelled right, it's easy to cross. So I don't have to embarrass myself too greatly, but it's kind of my perspective of where we started and how we got to the point where we're at, and the options that are out there. Now, clearly there's an initiative on the ballot that goes a significant step beyond where we currently are. I have great concerns about that. And my first concern with that is the expense of it. And my second concern is the quality of care behind that. Now, that will be something that will probably come up for debate in this group, as well as people that testify before this committee, but it's significant, and what it really points out to me is that it is time for change, because I think everybody is realizing the unsustainability of the current system. I think everybody is starting to realize that managed care really doesn't work very well, and we need to come up with something different than that. And I'm glad to be asked to sit on this, and I hope we can come up with some viable products that will fit. My goal in all of this, when I started this, what I was looking at was the rich benefit package that those in the Oregon Health Plan were receiving, and how the working poor who did not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan had nothing, and I thought that was unfair. And so the first thing I was looking at was, how do we develop a seamless system where the working poor have access to basic health care, and everything I have done has worked off of that premise. And I came up with what I think is a pretty good model, and as we go through this, maybe we can put some flesh on those bones.
Yeah. Well, those are good comments. I think it's instructive, and I think being one of the members that was here in 1991 and 1993 when we first funded the Oregon Health Plan, health care, both in the state of Oregon and nationally has changed pretty dramatically. And trying to keep up with those changes and transitions are difficult for anybody, as a private citizen trying to get reimbursement for prescription medications, you know, filling out the necessary forms and getting the right person can be daunting enough. But we do need to have a better understanding of where healthcare is going. It happens to be probably the primary issue in most union negotiations ongoing right now, most labor negotiations, including my own union, the Portland Police Association. That tends to be the sticking point. Healthcare cost drivers and just the cost of healthcare in general, that certainly exacerbates the problem of trying to provide medical care to persons who are in poverty. Senator Shields, I know you have to leave to go to a Mountain Community College board meeting.
Not so far.
Do you have any comments that you'd like to make?
No. Not at all. I'll just listen and keep the process moving.
All right, great. John Britton, you've been invited to come up here and share with us your understanding of the Oregon Health Plan with respect to the budget. And hopefully some of the presentations or information we'll get in front of us will create even more questions. I would like to add that Mr. Prinz is here from the Judiciary Committee at my request. The Joint Interim Judiciary Committee is working on a number of issues relevant to mental health issues and in the correction system, Department of Corrections, and so I wanted his legal mind here to facilitate some of those interests and others that the committee might have. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always dangerous. Well, let me introduce myself. I'm John Britton, and I work for the Legislative Fiscal Office. And one of my areas of responsibility is to assess the budget of the Oregon Health Plan. And as I said, it's dangerous than most of the people in the room know more about the subject than you do. I've been working on this for about 9 or 10 months. So the history of how we got here is also new to me. I wanted to talk a little bit this afternoon about the OMAP budget within the Department of Human Services, talk a little bit about eligibility for Oregon Health Plan services, discuss with you the Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver, and conclude, if you wish, Mr. Chair, with at least a brief discussion of some of the reductions that have been proposed, notwithstanding your comments about this is not a special session committee, it's an ongoing committee.
Mr. Britton, if you don't have a handout for us, can you get your comments written up so we can have a handout?
Senator Minnis and Senator Trow, of course. I have one handout for you in a little bit, but it is not an outline of my talk. This was just sort of jotted down this afternoon.
I think it'll be basic information, but we need it to have it.
Absolutely. And I can, one of the things I want to do is to give you some reading material, or at least point you in the direction of it that provides some of that basic information. To start with, obviously this is a complex area. Medical care, mental health care is a huge industry in this country and in this state. It involves physicians, hospitals, pharmacies, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, governmental entities, and all kinds of different programs. When you look at medical care in this country, you're really having to deal not just with Medicaid, of course, which is part of the Oregon Health Plan, but also Medicare and private insurance medical coverage as well. The DHS budget has approximately $4.9 billion of federal funds in it. That's federal funds only. And roughly 70% of that, along the lines of $3.3 billion, are Medicaid dollars. Generally, we get a 40-60 match, 40 cents general fund, 60 cents Medicaid dollars. And those Medicaid dollars are used to fund services for developmental disabilities, mental health services, long-term care. Senator Fisher knows firsthand, nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and the like. Of the approximately $3.3 billion of Medicaid federal funds, roughly $1.8, $1.9 billion are devoted to the Oregon Health Plan. Now, we use, in terms of state funds, about $1.1 billion at this point of general funds, tobacco settlement dollars, and tobacco tax, but $1.1 billion of state funds to match those federal Medicaid dollars. Within the medical assistance program, the Oregon Health Plan, and this is a $3 billion total funds budget, at least it was at the beginning of the biennium, and it's gone up about 4 or 5%, largely due to caseload increases because of the downturn in the economy. But of about a $3 billion total funds budget, $2.6 billion is for the Oregon Health Plan, $37 million for the Children's Health Insurance Program, $193 million Medicaid, but not the Oregon Health Plan. These cover people such as the medically needy program. $99 million funding about 200 positions, program support and the like. That's about 3.3% of the overall budget is admin and program support. And when the biennium began, at the close of the 2001 session, about $16 million of general fund only as special purpose appropriations to the emergency board. So generally, a total fund budget at the beginning of the biennium of about $3 billion total funds. As I indicated, the medical assistance program total fund budget has increased on the order of 4 to 5% in this biennium. That's somewhat unusual, and it is attributable largely to caseload increases because of the downturn in the economy. On the other hand, general funds within this budget has been reduced through special sessions by about $150 million. That $150 million is not primarily, to any extent, the result of program cuts. It's the result of backfilling that general fund with tobacco settlement dollars and tobacco tax in the third special session in particular. Today, as I said, we have a state fund budget within medical assistance programs of about $1.1 billion. $621 million of general funds, $209 tobacco settlement, $264 tobacco tax. $1,094 million of state funds. We do not know what the budget, we haven't seen the budget for the 2003-05 biennium, but I have heard we're looking at cost increases on the order of 30 to 40%.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Mr. Britton to repeat those numbers?
The state fund budget today, Senator Perioli?
Please.
Yeah. $621 million general fund, $209 tobacco settlement, $264 tobacco tax, and again, that being matched with about $1.9 billion of Medicaid dollars. There's also some shifts in children's health insurance program dollars, federal dollars in there as well. That 30 to 40% increase, if it's applied to state funds, represents about an increase of $330 to $440 million of state funds. All kinds of speculation as to what's driving those costs, and I have to say, as you indicated, Senator Minnis, this is not unique to Oregon. Nationally, we're seeing all kinds of increases in health care costs. So it's not necessarily too unique to Oregon's Medicaid program. People have pointed to rising hospital costs due to technology and labor shortages, prescription drug cost increases, aging population, and an increased utilization of services. So there are all kinds of ideas about why these health costs are increasing so dramatically. There are countless articles on the web that you can read about those cost increases, cost drivers.
John, before you get past it, because you did mention CHIP, would you tell us what the match rate for CHIP is and what percent of available CHIP dollars we're accessing currently?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, it's about a 3-to-1 match, federal to state funds. And let me look for a second. In the legislatively adopted budget, and this is again back to July of 01, we were spending about $11 million of state funds, $26.5 million of federal funds. And as Representative Cruz alluded to, this is a set amount of federal dollars. Each state is given an allotment of federal dollars, which is not the way Medicaid works. Medicaid, for every 40 cents, they will keep providing you 60 cents. CHIP, there's a set amount. And we have not been able to claim all of our federal CHIP dollars with the amount of general fund or state funds that we've put forward. So there is unclaimed CHIP dollars. I don't have the figure right with me, but there are.
And John, I didn't expect you to, but I do know that the match rate is much superior to Medicaid, and it's been one of our frustrations. And I think it's an area we need to look into is how we can get better access to those dollars and meld into whatever solutions we come up with.
All right. Thank you.
Are we limited simply because we don't have enough general fund dollars to match with it or anyway Oregon dollars to match to get those federal dollars? Or are we using all that we can get of the federal dollars?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trew, I want to make it clear we're not using all of the federal dollars currently.
So we could get.
Yes.
Because we've got people who qualify.
In other words, Oregon has been allotted X amount. We've only put forward enough general fund to get a certain proportion of that. However, I would
does that
add,
mean we're covering everybody though we should or not? We're still leaving people uncovered who need to have the opportunity to have this.
Well, we're not accessing all of our CHIP dollars. I'd leave it at that.
I understand that, but I want to know about the people. Are we covering everybody who qualifies? If that's one thing. If we're covering them, then we probably don't have to worry about not accessing, so we'd like to have more federal dollars. But if we're not covering them.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Crow, I believe there are about 450,000 people on the health plan, but there are about that number that are uninsured in Oregon.
Okay, who could qualify?
Not under our current eligibility requirements.
Okay.
How many are eligible but not served, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Now, one further point. Mr. Chair and Senator Crow, the OHP2 waiver, one of the goals of that waiver was to be able to access more of our CHIP dollars or use all of our CHIP dollars, particularly in our Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, where we have $20 million of tobacco settlement dollars that when we left back in July of 01, were not matched with any federal dollars.
Okay.
So one of the goals of the waiver was to match FEOP, certainly, but to grab more of those CHIP, unused CHIP dollars.
Mm-hmm. We've been able to do that?
The way, Mr. Chair and Senator Trull talked about the waiver in a bit, but it appears that we will be able to do a lot of that under the new waiver, yes. Mm-hmm. And that waiver has not yet been approved, but it is apparently very close.
Okay.
If I could respond to Senator Trow a little bit, it's one of the catch-22s in the system. Those who are qualified for Medicaid, that that is the program they're in. We can't take people who would we can't take kids and move them into CHIP if they're qualified for Medicaid. So to a degree, some of the people who tried to move that direction have reverted back into Medicaid. So that's part of the conundrum.
Okay, and I assume that's some federal regulation.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, I think that's a good comment because the CHIP program was designed to cover more children. That's why it was designed. It's newer than Medicaid, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me talk briefly about eligibility. and I'll display my ignorance, but I do want to hand one thing out to you. What Rick has handed to you is a simple spreadsheet that was provided to me by the Department of Human Services. It is a caseload summary that on the far right shows you that it was the April rebalance that was actually used in the June Department of Human Services rebalance. You can see that we cover under the medical assistance program about 450 Oregonians. Now, generally speaking, these sets of groupings or categories are really divided into two groups for the purposes of a waiver discussion. One is categorical categories, if you will, and the other is new eligibles. Now, on this chart, the new eligible population are OHP adults who have children, and the one right below it, OHP childless adults. Those are called new eligibles, and they are covered under Medicaid by virtue of the waiver that is currently in force, known as the Oregon Health Plan. The other groupings on here, the other groups are categorical for the most part. And you can see generally what they are, some information that I have, which I will happily give to you, talks about the income levels and so on. But for example, the first one, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. These are people and families that are on receiving cash assistance under the TANF program, about 61,000 persons in the April rebalance. The other thing to note on here is you can see on the far left the LAB. This is the legislatively adopted budget. And it's interesting to note these are average monthly caseloads for the Department of Human Services medical assistance programs, how certain of the caseloads have gone up. Again, this is a primary cost driver to our 4-5% increase during the current biennium. Caseloads, especially amongst those that are economically sensitive, went up. Certainly the new eligible caseloads went up from about, looks like, 39,254 adults who have children, plus the 53,752 below it, adults, childless adults, up to approximately 110,000 over the course of about the first 9 or 10 months of the biennium. Those are, generally speaking, persons up to 150% of federal poverty level. And as the economy worsened, more people fell into that eligibility category. On the other hand, you look at aid to the blind, disabled, and the one right below it, old age assistance. Those caseloads have not grown over the course of the biennium, really, to speak of. It's a fairly predictable group of people, and they are on the health plan not because they're unemployed, but because they have disabilities or they're old and they have low income.
John, if I can divert you here for a second, on the new eligibles that you talked about, you said they're 150% of poverty level.
I'm sorry, Senator.
On the new eligibles that you just mentioned, the new eligibles?
Let me go over that with you. They are at 100% of federal poverty level.
Oh, I thought you said 150%.
They're at 100% of federal poverty level right now.
The adults.
That's right.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I thought you said
let me complicate your lives a little bit more. Following people are covered by the Medicaid component of the Oregon Health Plan. Persons receiving cash assistance under temporary assistance to needy families. Families transitioning from TANF into employment who are eligible for 12 months after cash assistance ends. That's at the bottom of a list called TANF Extended. Children in foster care or for whom adoption assistance payments are made. Persons in the Poverty Level Medical Program, PLM, which includes children from birth to age 5 in households with incomes up to 133% of federal poverty level, children 6 to 18 in households with incomes up to 100% of federal poverty level, pregnant women and their newborns in households with incomes up to 170% of federal poverty level. Persons who are age 65 or over with incomes under 81% of the federal poverty level. Blind and disabled persons with incomes under 81% of the federal poverty level. General assistance recipients who are unable to work for at least 12 months, have no children, and have incomes and resources under $50. And then, as I indicated a moment ago, adults who have children and childless adults up to 100% of federal poverty level. So, by and large, pretty low income levels for all of these eligibility groups. OHP 2 waiver and House Bill 2519. And I'm smiling at Representative Cruz because, again, he could talk far more than I can on this. But I want to focus on one element, and that is the Oregon Health Plan waiver. Generally, there were several goals with respect to this waiver that was the department was directed to undertake in House Bill 2519. One was to expand the number of persons on the Oregon Health Plan, but do it in a budget, state budget neutral way. And that was done by saying we are going to reduce the benefit package for this new eligible group. Again, OHP adults who have children, OHP childless adults. Reduce that benefit package, use the savings to expand that group, that particular group, up the federal poverty level.
Question, how long is that budget neutrality supposed to exist? Is that in perpetuity?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's my understanding. Now, having said that, it's difficult to track it.
Okay.
Yes.
All right,
but that has been a focus of mine. There has been extensive analysis done on both state budget neutrality and federal budget neutrality. To get the waiver through, you have to satisfy the Fed that you've achieved federal budget neutrality. And the two budget neutrality concepts are not the same by any means.
Are those terms of the waiver or terms of the legislation or both?
Mr. Chair and Senator Trow, the federal budget neutrality is certainly has to be a part of a condition for the Fed to buy off on this.
Okay.
The state budget neutrality wasn't specified in those exact words in 2519, but it was part of the understanding of the emergency board and I think the leadership commission on healthcare costs when they gave the nod to go ahead with this particular waiver application back in May.
Okay.
The state budget neutrality was a cap number. The federal budget neutrality is not a cap number because caseload increase would still bring in new dollars. It was a budget neutrality as far as where the money, who the money went to and things like that. But clearly, if we suddenly had 100,000 more Medicaid eligible people, they wouldn't expect us to service them with the same dollar figure we had had before.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
John, I just want to make sure I've got this in my mind. The underlying rationale for the waiver was to reduce the funding per client, but to increase the numbers of clients served.
Madam Chair and Senator Farrioli, it was for the new eligible population. So the idea was to reduce the benefit package and use those savings to expand the group in such a way that we would have no impact on the state budget.
Excuse me, that was part of the purpose. The other part of the purpose was to try to adjust provider reimbursement rates also, because we, in our study, we found that the provider reimbursement rates are so low that especially in rural parts of the state, there was no longer access to the system because physicians, for example, could only afford to lose money on so many of the patients. They had to have some that they actually made money on. So part of what we were hoping to be able to do with it was to increase reimbursement rates so that there would be more access to those who are eligible.
Senator Cho.
Have we been able to do a study to see exactly how that then did play out, how much this went to? We reduced the package, clearly, of the benefits, but how much did that result in new people getting it, and how much did it go to provider payments?
Madam Chair and Senator Trell, the waiver hasn't been approved, so it has not yet happened. But we have done, and the Department of Human Services has done, as I said, a fairly, in my opinion, reasonable assessment of state budget neutrality. So I have a stack about like that on my desk over state budget neutrality.
Are you guessing we're going to get some additional numbers, or are we going to increase provider payments mostly?
Madam Chair and Senator Trow, the analysis that I've reviewed mm-hmm. has primarily been the exchange between a reduction of benefits for new people,
mm-hmm.
a factoring of higher reimbursement rates has not been part of that analysis.
Okay, so we don't know that.
We don't know.
Senator Crowe, increased reimbursement rates were clearly a part of House Bill 2519, and it was something that was talked about all through the session. When we got to the task force after session, discussion of that just stopped entirely. I think it's an appropriate part of this discussion, and it certainly will come into play. You need to keep in mind that we haven't got the federal response from the waiver request yet. There are still many miles to go before we have a finished product here. So hopefully we can re-energize that part of the discussion.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, I don't know whether to ask the question of John or to Representative Cruz, but why is it that we have just stayed on expansion into new eligibles without, I mean, it would seem to me that the two ought to be concurrent. I mean, they're both problems, they're both present. Why aren't we kind of doing a dual focus and looking at provider rates at the same time we're looking at the expansion of eligibles?
Okay. Senator Shields, as a member of that task force, I guess, I'm not sure why you would have to ask Gene Thorne and the governor why they chose to put the focus where they did.
But I think that the focus that Representative Cruz is talking about in the question here is we all know from reading many accounts that there are many providers out there that have gone broke trying to provide this system, so reimbursement rates are shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't have proper reimbursement. We won't have a system that works. Senator Ferriere.
Madam Chairman, I understand the concept of thinning the soup, which is more persons and a lower level of services. But revenue neutrality with a 30 to 40% projected increase in costs doesn't square. So I guess I need to know if we're taking a snapshot in time for revenue neutrality for the waiver, in order to get the waiver, so that we can add tens of thousands of more new eligibles, which is what I see in the spreadsheet, and we're projecting a 30 to 40% increase in cost, which will be $330 to $340 million. Are we just trying the strategy? Is the strategy obtaining the waiver only based on a snapshot in time without any concept of what the projected cost increases will be? Because it appears to me that we're talking about revenue neutrality, which is
it's incomprehensible that we would talk about revenue neutrality knowing we have a 30 to 40% projected increase in costs, driven by other factors perhaps than increased eligibility. There's inflation, there's increasing and escalating costs, there's a desire to reimburse providers more equitably. But how do we square the concept of revenue neutrality and the concept of a 30 to 40% increase in the same equation?
Madam Chair and Senator Ferriolli, there are a couple responses I would make to that. One is that, at least as the way it has been represented to me, state budget neutrality did not mean that we would keep the health plan budget neutral, the overall health plan. That's one comment. In other words, the waiver was not primarily a mechanism to keep the overall health plan budget neutral. That's one comment. Secondly, in fact, when we built in some increases, some inflationary increases to the budget neutrality model, it didn't have a significant impact on the overall cost of the program. And the reason for that was that if you assume that the benefits for these 100,000 people, the new eligible group, are going up, let's say 20, 30, 40%, so also are the savings that you derive when you reduce the benefit package. So that when you're looking strictly at the budget neutrality model, high cost increases didn't really affect the overall budget neutrality of adding new people under the expansion for the new eligible group. Because I looked at that.
Madam Chairman, I understand that. I worry about myself because I think I understand that.
Okay.
Okay. But that is on a theoretical model at one moment in time. But in the reality of the world of reimbursements and costs and new eligibles, those real costs are going to go up several hundred million dollars in the next biennium. So I guess that just after a truth and discussion here, I think the idea of budget neutrality is a fallacious concept. I think it might be used as an argument to sell the feds on a waiver. And, you know, I can understand the tap dance is, hey, look, you know, we're going to have a whole bunch of more people here, but we're really not going to take any money out of this system. We may provide a few less services across the board, but we're going to add thousands more people to this program, and therefore it becomes a more universal healthcare offering. And I think that's the selling point. And then budget neutrality is something that we tell legislators, but in order to get them to support the idea. But the bottom line is we're talking about $330 to $340 million of increase, and that's got to come. Those are real dollars. Those aren't budget neutral dollars or discussions to the contrary. Those are real dollars that are going to have to come from the general fund or from the tobacco security funds or from the tobacco tax or from some yet unnamed revenue source. And I guess I'm wanting to put that into perspective. Is this a sustainable program? Does the waiver put us in deeper water than we're in now? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I can see that Representative Cruz would like to respond to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ferriolli, when we started this process last January, we were somewhat optimistic in thinking that we would get through our process and get through the federal process in such a fashion that we might be into a new waiver for a significant portion of this biennium. And so from one of the real concerns of leadership was that the transition would be budget neutral, that if the general fund budget that was put on the board, on the table for the Oregon Health Plan would cover whatever the transition was. So when we went to the new program, the general fund expenditure was the same. Okay, so that was one aspect that was the main concern of the Senate President and the Speaker and the co-chairs, as we're going through this. That was what they were referring to as budget neutrality. On the federal side, where the real issue there is that because we have all of these new eligible people who are not technically qualified for Medicaid that we are covering, and the budget neutrality from the federal side is that suddenly we aren't going to be asking for a whole bunch more Medicaid dollars for non-Medicaid eligible people. So that pot of money, which was part of the waiver, would be fairly stable. Now, those who are eligible, that population can rise, and it doesn't have an impact on budget neutrality from the federal level. But because we have a waiver that allows us to extend Medicaid dollars to non-eligible people, they would not look favorably upon us saying that everybody in the state of Oregon should be eligible for Medicaid. Okay, so.
And Madam Chairman, it's taken quite a while to get this budget or this waiver discussion off dead center, and we still do not have a waiver. Is that?
No, we do not.
We do not. And it's been several months since the waiver's been applied for.
Yes.
It seems to me that the federal agencies must be at some level skeptical of our commitment in this area, and perhaps they're right to be skeptical. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Troll.
Have we recruited these new eligibles thinking they'll be covered by a waiver that's prospective, and we haven't got it yet, and we're paying for them anyway or something?
Madam Chair and Senator Crow, to my knowledge, we have not marketed the program. I think people are aware of it, advocates are aware of it, but people have not been added to the caseload by virtue of the waiver because it's not in place yet.
Okay, so we really haven't gone after that group.
Yeah,
these new eligibles are just eligible otherwise.
That's right. They're eligible today. This is what our caseload projection is today. I want to try and clarify one thing, and that is that when we say there's a 30 to 40% potential cost increase, the point is that the waiver was not one of the drivers of that 30 to 40%. That's what, in simple terms, we were talking about in terms of state budget neutrality. That was not the only goal of the waiver. As we talked about earlier, one of the goals was to get federal match on $20 million of tobacco settlement that's in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. That program is one where we subsidize commercial insurance premiums for primarily low-income working persons, individuals, and right now, to a far lesser extent, some groups.
The current caseload is about on the order of 4,000 persons under FEOP, and the waiver, as we proposed it to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, would increase that by about 25,000. So it's a significant increase over on the FEOP side. And one thing that was important or is important in terms of budget is that the waiver was to provide some modest budget flexibility. By that I mean that one of the terms of the waiver that we proposed and it looks like we are going to get from CMS is the ability to further reduce benefits for the new eligible group down to a Medicaid minimal level. Now, there was all kinds of discussion and calculations by an actuary in front of the Waiver Advisory Steering Committee as to the percentage of value of the current benefit package that this new standard benefit package would be. Eventually, the waiver that we submitted assumed a 78% value level. That is, it went from 100% and removed, for example, vision benefits. We removed half of adult dental. We imposed more cost sharing in the form of copays and premiums. And the eventual benefit value of that benefit package as submitted to CMS was about 78% of the current
package that we offer under the Oregon Health Plan. The waiver would allow us to take it on down to about 56%, which is the Medicaid minimal level. So that offers some modicum of budget flexibility, and that was certainly another part of the goal here.
Mr. Chair, on that point, sorry to keep interrupting.
All right.
From what happened in the task force, there was an incredible amount of discussion on the copays, simply because the copays as presented are not collectible. And this committee needs to know that the task force vote on that, it was adopted on a 10-9 vote. Okay. I was one of the nine, as was Senator Fischer, I believe. And on the copays, none of that, Senator? Yeah. There's some real problems there. And that's one of the things we need to look at as we move forward, because we can still adjust some of these things when we get the response from CMS. But clearly, if we are doing things in this Remake the Oregon Health Plan that is just pure cost shift, we aren't necessarily helping the healthcare system. So just to let you know that part of the waiver was incredibly controversial. We spent an incredible amount of time, and the task force was pretty evenly split on whether it was a good idea or not.
All right. Thank you.
I would be remiss if I didn't say that the Department of Human Services and the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which operates FEOP, has begun implementation efforts. They are expecting the waiver to be approved by CMS very soon, and the emergency board has an agenda item, or will have an agenda item before it, to approve additional staffing and expenditure limitation for both the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Department of Human Services to implement this waiver once it has been approved. In terms of the modest budget flexibility, and this leads me to my last section that I want to talk about this afternoon, I've asked the department, all right, if we were put in a position where we had to reduce benefits down to that Medicaid minimal level for the new eligible population, what kind of savings are we looking at in the current biennium? How fast could that be implemented, assuming the waiver were approved? We're looking at about $15.8 million of general fund. That's about 4 months' worth.
And assume that's with the population of individuals receiving benefits staying the same? Or?
Mr. Chair, it's the new eligible group, the 100,000 people in OHP standard, who would go from that 78% benefit level on down to 56% of the benefit level. And that, effectively, though, it means removing prescription drugs. It means eliminating the remaining half of adult dental care, mental health, chemical dependency, among other things.
Senator Kerr.
What's the process that the waiver allows, or what is the process we will use to make that decision? How's it made?
Mr. Chair and Senator Crowe, one of the features of this waiver is that reduction can be made without CMS approval. It would take, obviously, legislative approval or a legislative directive.
Does it take just an act of the Ways and Means Committee, or does it take legislation through the entire body or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crowe, I don't know the real answer to that. I suspect that it would take overall legislative approval, just as a budget does. That's a significant step in terms of a budget, and to be able to reduce general fund requirements.
I think it could be done as part of the budget process, though, without a specific bill that would be passed related to it.
Mr. Chair, I think it would require a bill. It has to be passed. Okay. That's my non-legal opinion. But it does not require CMS approval, and that's where the flexibility comes into play. Typically, if you want to make reductions to benefit packages or to the eligibility groups, you have to go through generally a fairly protracted process with CMS.
Madam Chairman, or Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fairlawn.
Thank you. So what we would be talking about here is a addition of people who are not currently served to the level equivalent to Medicaid.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, we're talking about a new eligible group by virtue of being on the waiver today and increasing the federal poverty level of eligibility. Now, initially, what we've indicated, as I understand it, to CMS is to say instead of 100% of federal poverty level, we're looking at 110%. One of the conditions that the E-Board included was that the legislature will determine when another 15% of federal poverty level would be added to further expand that new eligible group. In theory, the thought was to take that all the way up to 185% of federal poverty level, significantly higher than where it is today. Realistically, that's probably not where we're going to end up.
And Mr. Chairman, are we still working within the framework of budget neutrality?
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, for what it's worth to budget neutrality, yes. Yes.
There's simply a failure of logic here, Mr. Chairman. It just is not logical that you can go to 185% of federal poverty, add tens of thousands of currently ineligible people, and still talk about budget neutrality. It doesn't make sense.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
I think budget neutrality under that thing is decided by whether the person is eligible or new eligible or not. It doesn't mean that it's the same amount of money in the budget. It's the amount of money that would have been spent on that group of people originally, if they've been included. So it does not mean budget neutrality has the same level of money. It means budget neutrality in the fact that anybody that was eligible wouldn't get any more than you got before. But if there were more eligible added, that would have been budget neutral, just as long as it fit into that program.
Mr. Chairman, I thank my good colleague from Roseburg for adding the first lucid detail that I've been able to apprehend here. So it's not budget neutrality, it's equivalent
in total. Yeah, in total dollars. It's budget neutrality is the fact that you're not spending any more on you would have before if it had been.
And with apologies to Mr. Britton, it's just that detail that I was missing. It's not budget neutrality, meaning no additional dollars. It's equivalent spending we're talking about. In any case, Mr. Chairman, I think it's many more dollars we're talking about spending, by about $340 million more. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Farioli, you may have stepped out of the room. One thing I did say was that the 30% to 40% increase in cost that we're projecting is not a result of the waiver itself.
I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to conclude, Mr. Chair, by at least alerting you to the reduction options for the Oregon Medical Assistance Programs, and that had been on the governor's $482 million reduction list. They total for OMAP, and these are reductions which do not require statutory changes. However, I would tell you that some of them require federal changes, and presumably those timelines to get federal approval have been taken into account. They total about $31.6 million of general fund, $44.4 million of matching federal dollars. They include such things as reducing Oregon Health Plan pharmacy reimbursement to average wholesale price minus 17%. Currently, we're at AWP minus 14%.
I'm watching Tom Holt to see if he goes apoplectic on me here.
Do not distribute the safety net clinic funding. The emergency board did release that, what was left of the special purpose appropriation for safety net clinics, $1.2 million. Change the beginning date of health plan eligibility from the time you actually get on the health plan instead of the time you may receive services, about $1.7 million of general funds. Eliminate outlier payments for DRG hospitals and reduce DRG unit value. These essentially are the rates we pay diagnostic-related groupings payment system for large hospitals, $3.4 million of general funds. Eliminate the medically needy program, $6.9 million general fund. Eliminate what is left in this biennium of the Children's Health Insurance Program, $1.2 million. And finally, one here, reductions to this point are insufficient, another $12 million of general fund that would probably be garnered under the new waiver through the mechanism that I just mentioned, that is benefit reductions in the new eligible benefit package or the standard package. Under the current waiver, you're looking at moving the line on the prioritized list of medical services, which is, again, a tough way to go in terms of federal approval.
You have more material than you
I'm pretty much talked down.
Senator Ferriola.
Mr. Chairman, I understand Mr. Britton heard about this assignment after 10:30 this morning. And that it's not surprising that he doesn't have this material available for us in handout form. But I appreciate his presentation, and I would like to request that we do, in fact, get the presentation that he made in a handout form at our next meeting.
I appreciate that, and to the extent that you can put it together, I mean, your table will do this, but the time may not permit, in some form of logical, sequential organization.
Well, Mr. Chair, I tried to be somewhat sequentially logical.
Well, for me, I'm visually oriented. If I see something, I tend to remember it pretty well. But if I've got things floating around in space, it's more difficult for me. So it would be helpful to have that. Now, for the committee, we've got some binders over here and hopefully a three-hole punch because my expectations will get a lot of material and I'd like you to start collecting it and reading it. John, we're through with you for today, although I think the question of sustainability is a good one. I don't know if you've had a chance to give much thought to it or if that's one of the things that you would ordinarily do, but perhaps that's one of the questions I'd like to get into at some point is given the current environment, population growth, audiences, people receiving benefits, can we sustain this program? What's its growth pattern look like? I don't even know if we have anybody that does that kind of analysis.
Mr. Chair, I would say that one place to perhaps look a little bit, although I don't know that there's been a whole lot of work done on this, but one of the provisions of House Bill 2519 had a health care cost index study, I guess, that was required. And I don't know if, Rick, you know where that is, but I don't think there's been a whole lot on that, but again, I think the idea was to chart where we think healthcare costs are going over some future years, and that might be a reasonable place to look.
Are you aware of any statutory directives that were authorized when the Oregon Health Plan was first created that deals with times like these, recessions where money becomes tight, is there any statutory directive to reduce program or?
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar. I don't know about them, no.
You're not familiar with that?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, and I assume not knowing that, then you wouldn't know whether the agency's requested from the federal government the opportunity to send the suit based on our ability to pay.
Mr. Chair? I think that was part and parcel of the waiver with the idea of being able to change the number.
the second man.
I want to delve into those questions a little bit, too. My understanding is there is a statutory provision that I haven't seen yet that gives some direction to times when the economy is bad, recession occurs that there is the, at least the statutory authority to reduce benefit, but it requires some federal approval. But my understanding is no one's bothered to ask the feds for that approval. But
yeah,
I don't know if you're...
Mr. Chair, so far, the all requests to move the line have just been from the executive branch, but the legislature does have the authority to move the line and make the request. And my sense has always been that if it was a joint request from the executive branch and the legislative branch, it would carry more weight. I'd also like to say that if you're looking for what's happening with indexing, maybe Rick should get a hold of John Santos and ask him what's happening there. And I would have a conversation with my good friend Ruby Houghton, and I would also suggest that if we want somebody who has a well-ordered portfolio on all of this stuff, that maybe we should contact her Spotford, that she probably has a computer record as anybody.
I think it may be a little bit late in the day, but we'll see if we can't get a communication first thing in the morning to ask the agency to come over and give us a presentation on the Oregon Health Plan. I've got some questions myself in general.
Maybe also ask first to reproduce his documentation. It's probably fairly complete.
Okay. That's a good idea. When I was here in 93 again, the idea was we were going to cover 400,000 people who didn't have health insurance. And I think we're covering,
450,000 roughly.
450,000. And do I recall correctly, there's supposed to be another 400,000 that don't have?
That's my understanding.
I'm a little confused about where those figures come from. And
Mr. Chair, I think John Santa can clarify.
Yeah, so maybe we can get the agency to come in and kind of give us a sketch of the back. And background and framework of the Oregon Health Plan and who the target audiences are and generate yet even more questions.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Fisher.
I have one suggestion. If you want to check this out for sustainability, that you don't give it over to the Economic Forecast Group.
Well, their track record recently has not been so good, has it? The other thing is kind of want to put this out over here. Insurance agencies or people that deal with, operating. And this is kind of an insurance program for the most part, although they don't have the same kind of reserves. They rely on federal funds, et cetera. I'm a little curious about what kind of input we might or wisdom we might gain from the insurance industry with respect to how they function, how they operate, and whether or not privatizing the Oregon Health Plan is an idea that could even realistically be pursued, at least privatizing the administration of the program. I'm just wondering whether there may be some cost savings there. And I don't, have you had any input from private industry with respect to cost savings in the administration of the program?
Well, Mr. Chair, I know, and I wasn't a budget analyst on this, we looked at a number of ways to try and save money in terms of the 2001-03 budget. And there were a number of pharmaceutical cost savings that have been implemented. Also, again, we have about 75% of the people who are covered under the health plan under managed care, effectively trying to privatize or shift at least financial risk to the managed care organizations. And they probably could be informative about how you can save money in terms of the fee-for-service line. Now, whether you could implement all of those things is another matter.
Yeah, that's our biggest problem, isn't it, implementing anything. Okay, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator.
The audit report that is dated January 3rd, 2002 has within it a response from the agency. The audit report itself is about 10 pages in length. And the response to the audit report is about 5 sentences in length. And it's included in the handout that we received today. And I just urge the members to read through this audit report. on eligibility, there's a companion audit report that was done at the same time on encounter data that's just as interesting. It has a similar length and heft, about 8 pages in length, and the response from the agency is about 5 sentences. And I would suggest that it makes very interesting reading, indicating that there is significant leakage in the system in intake eligibility and significant leakage in the system in terms of encounter data review. And to me, I think the responses from the agencies are completely inadequate to the questions that are brought up in the audit report. So I would like to hear from this agency what its progress is in enacting a different eligibility review process, because I personally cannot explain to working poor people who are not currently eligible for the Oregon Health Plan how illegal aliens are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and are currently being served by the Oregon Health Plan when they cannot get the benefit. And I cannot understand how we can allow charting errors and inaccuracies in billing to accrue to the kind of numbers that are indicated in this audit. So if the members have not seen the encounter data review audit, I hope that we can get that for the staff, for the committee members. And please, members, take a minute to breeze through this audit and look at the response by the agency. And I would like to hear the agency expand on its efforts to cure the problems that were disclosed by this audit. When I talked to the auditors who did this report, Kathy Polano and others, it was clear at that point in time that they felt there was a great deal more potential area to be audited, but they had not been given that instruction. And perhaps it would be good to have the folks from the Secretary of State's office come in and talk about this audit as well. It's a great point of departure, and it has, I think, great implications for potential savings in the Oregon Health Plan. And I just want to defer to Representative Cruz, who mentioned early on that the effort was not to destroy the Oregon Health Plan, but to save it. And the only way to save it is to make it sustainable. And if it is currently unsustainable, trying to continue an unsustainable program will kill it faster than anything. And so I just want to commend him for his efforts and just reiterate his comment. We're here to save the Oregon Health Plan if we can. And to do that means to make it sustainable.
Okay. Good comments. I think we'll extend an invitation to the Secretary of State's office and talk about the audit. And again, at short notice, hopefully we can have them come in and talk about it. Anybody in the audience who has an interest in or would like to present or at least share with us their views of the Oregon Health Plan, you're welcome to do so. Just contact the staff here and we'll gather your information also. And we're going to meet again at 10 o'clock in the morning in this room. We may or may not have anything to do depending on whether we can get any messages to the Secretary of State's office or others to come in and talk about it, but maybe our administrator can find some additional information for us to go over to help get us up to speed. And Representative Cruz, if you can be here, I would appreciate that too.
Absolutely.
And any other comments? John, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. We're adjourned.